Continuing with the chapter called Unshakable Freedom. So we had just last time finished the story of the king of Kalinga, who had been helping the Bodhisattva to develop the quality of patience, and who, it is said, according to some accounts, was Anyakondanya, the Buddha's first disciple who entered stream entry in a later appearance. Another good example of a transcendent virtue is equanimity, upekkha. In one jataka, the great being decided to perfect this paramita. He lived as an ascetic, sitting out in the blazing sun all day and going naked in the chill of the night, sleeping on thorns and rocks, drinking water from puddles and eating leaves. All this was intended to develop equanimity. He did this for 80 years, constantly testing the body in order to become equanimous to pain and discomfort. However, as asceticism is a negation of the body and inflicts unnecessary hardship, it leads to a rebirth in hell. So when the ascetic died, he went straight to hell. As he saw the gates of hell loom up ahead of him, he thought, that life was a complete waste of time. Oh well, never mind. And at that moment, he perfected equanimity and immediately went up to the heavenly realms. This is where snakes and ladders comes from, you realize. It's an Indian game. So down the long snake, and then whoop, next thing you know, up the tallest ladder. Such stories give you another perspective when your boss is hollering at you for something that wasn't finished yesterday. It helps you to remember what you can get right, what you can take with you, and where your real home is. To remember that feels good and gives you strength when times are hard. To remember that feels good and gives you strength when times are hard. When the reflections on insight, cessation, and nibbana lose their appeal, having such a fable in mind helps one find the aspiration to keep going in the face of the stuff that life brings up. And the results are good. Life can give you spiritual strength and a sense of purpose if its mundane routines are highlighted in this way. For example, to be patient, generous, kind, moral, and wise are qualities to perfect. Any action that brings these perfections into the world has the capacity to awaken the transcendent side of the mind. When you rise to the occasion, the result is that you feel good in yourself. And maybe a couple of stories also to tell around this, where people who are, on the basic principle of, and this is a theme I bring up over and over again, I can't imagine how many Dhamma talks and expositions, but it's the simple principle that when we think of something as being good or a success, think, oh, that was this is great, fantastic, I got what I wanted. And then a few years later, we realize, I can't believe I was celebrating. That ended up being the worst thing that ever happened to me. Getting that job, getting married to that person, divorcing that person, coming into the monastery, leaving the monastery. And you think, oh, fantastic, at last I got what I wanted. This is great. And then 5 years later, 10 years later, you're rolling your eyes. I can't believe I was celebrating. What an idiot. And similarly, when things fall apart and things are really difficult, you get some kind of horrible illness, or you get all your money ripped off, or you get fired from that job, or you come back home and your partner's disappeared and taken all the money. And you, at the time, it's a disaster, it's a crisis, it's awful, it's the worst. But then, how many times, 5 or 10 years later, we realize, well, I would never, ever have asked for that to happen, but actually that was really wonderful. That was the best thing that ever happened to me. Yeah. The brother of one of the former monks of this community, Ajahn Subhuto, his brother got AIDS in the very early period of its existence in the world, in the human world, in the 80s. And that was a comment that his brother made as he was dying. That he said, you think it sounds crazy, but getting AIDS is the best thing that's ever happened to me. And he died of it. He died. But it was a genuine and clear insight that he regarded that his life was very foolish and shallow and messed up. And even though it was a short period of time, he learned a lot from that, the early death and the illness that came. Similarly, you have this these kind of beliefs is quite common in the Buddhist world, that the idea that what you're thinking of at the last moment is what matters, and that is going to guarantee the destination after you're reborn. And there are many, many stories like that. Or we might think that somehow some kind of life that's been very, very unskillful is necessarily going to take you down to the hell realms. But none of these things are guaranteed. So there's a couple of stories from the Buddha's lifetime. One is, this is a very popular story around people who like to drink, because it's called Sarakani, who took to drink. And there was this disciple of the Buddha in Kapilavatthu called Sarakani, who was a notorious drunk. They didn't have alcoholics in those days, just people who drank a lot. So Sarakani was a notorious drunk around Kapilavatthu, but he did have great faith in the Buddha and in the Triple Gem. And when Sarakani passed away, as people would often do, they'd go and see the Buddha. He was staying in Kapilavatthu at the time, and said, so what's happened to Sarakani? Where's he gone? Because occasionally the Buddha would say, oh, such and such a being has gravitated to this realm or that realm. And they're all expecting him to say, oh, he's going to be reborn as a dog or as a maggot in a vineyard or something. And the Buddha, to their amazement, says, oh, if Sarakani was a stream enterer, he's been reborn in a bright realm. I'm like, what? He was a stream enterer, but he was a drunk. And the Buddha said, yes, he was. But he also had, even though he was a drunk, he had great faith in the Triple Gem. And at the time of his death, then his mind was able to experience that, the benefits of the faith that he had, and that ripened in stream entry. So that's what happened. And they said, the rumor goes around Kapilavatthu. This is incredible. Anybody can be a stream enterer these days. The price has really dropped. So then this whole rumor mill and the version of Twitter of the Buddha era version of Twitter goes twittering around Kapilavatthu, and stories come back. Everyone's sort of upset and amazed, and how can the Buddha possibly say this? This can't be true. And then he talks about different qualifications for stream entry, and he goes through more and more sort of simple examples. And he said, even if these sala trees here were able to understand what is good and what is not good, what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, I would say that even these trees are stream enterers, because really that's what it takes, that in the heart they recognize this is good. And so he really drives a point home, and it gives a very interesting reflection on stream entry. So it's not always just defined in terms of the say breaking through self-view and doubt and attachment to rules and precepts and conventions, but the quality of faith, a sense of unwavering faith in the Triple Gem, is also a way of categorizing it, and also that sense of that in the heart which can understand what's good, even if you can't do the good all the time. what the good is, and what the harmful is. Another similar story, which is more commentarial, is of the story of the state executioner called Tambadatika, which means copper teeth. And he'd been a bandit, and he and his gang were captured at one time. And then I think the story went that after they were captured, he killed all the other members of the gang while they were locked up, and so he was the only one left alive. And so they thought, well, this guy's obviously got no morals and no heart. He'd be a good executioner. So they spared him, and he became the state executioner for about 40 years. And then and he got into his 60s. His arm was no longer strong enough to be able to kill his victims with a single blow. So he got retired. And then, as a retired executioner, he started to get interested in spiritual things. And he invited Venerable Sariputta to come to his house and have a meal. And then Sariputta came along, he offered the meal, and then shortly afterwards, Tambadatika died. And so then they went to the Buddha and said, well, what happened to Tambadatika? You know, he was the state executioner, he cut the heads off hundreds and hundreds of people over the years. And the Buddha said, oh, he's gone to a very, very fine destination. He's gone up to I don't think he was a stream enterer. I think Tambadatika just got reborn in the Tavatinsa heaven. They said, Tavatinsa heaven? But yeah, he was covered in scars, and his teeth had been smashed out, so he had these copper teeth. And he was the most sort of gruesome and violent character. And the Buddha said, well, you know, he created a lot of bad karma, but at the end of his life, then that was... he had just heard a Dhamma talk from Venerable Sariputta, and there was sufficient good karma to make him be able to understand that, and his mind was in a bright state, and then he got killed by a runaway cow, knocking him down, and was reborn in the Tavatinsa heaven. So sometimes you get a lucky break. The odds are in that favor. So, and the last story I often tell in respect to this, because it's more of a Buddhist myth that everything depends on the last thought. And you, like in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it makes a big emphasis on that. And in the commentarial literature of the Theravada, it makes a big thing about that what the mind is focusing on in the last moment makes all the difference. But there's another story, again in Kapilavatthu, and this is a relative of the Buddha called Mahanama, was the ruler of the Sakyans at that time. And he went to the Buddha and said, you know, I'm really worried because I'm the ruler, I'm the Raja here. And, you know, my mind is always filled with these worries, you know, all the affairs of state and the protecting the kingdom and the finances and the attacks from the borders and taxing people. And my head is filled with thinking and worries. And I'm concerned that if I get knocked down in the street, you know, or some accident happens, you know, when I die, I'm going to have my head, you know, filled with all this list of sort of kingly nonsense, and so I'm worried that I'm going to die in a bad state. And then the Buddha said, well, don't be afraid, Mahanama, don't be afraid, because you know, for many, many years you create a lot of good karma, and even though that your thoughts might be dwelling on worldly and insignificant matters. That you're when you die, because of the faith that's established, you will rise to distinction. And he gives this very beautiful analogy. He said, if you imagine taking an earthenware pot, like a little clay pot that's filled with ghee, like with fine oil, and you take that clay pot and you submerge it in some water, then you break the pot. Then what will happen? So Mahanama said, well, if you have a pot full of ghee and you put it in water and you break it, then the shards of pottery, the broken bits of earthenware, will sink to the bottom, and the oil will rise up. And the Buddha said, exactly so, because your heart has been established in faith in the Triple Gem for so many years, then just as the body breaks and the elements, the earth element returns to the earth and so forth, there your mind will rise up. Your mind will rise to distinction. So don't be afraid, Mahanama, don't be afraid. That's a reassurance in case you're worried about not having a clear mind at the last moment. That it's more benefit is to be found in how we live, and the quality of faith and understanding is really central to that. So, Life can give you spiritual strength and a sense of purpose if its mundane routines are highlighted in this way. For example, to be patient, generous, kind, moral and wise are qualities to perfect. Any action that brings these perfections into the world has the capacity to awaken the transcendent side of the mind. When you rise to the occasion, the result is that you feel good in yourself. In the first watch of the night, when Buddhas awaken to some aspects of transcendent truth, they realize their true lineage. It's a spiritual lineage, an evolution of wisdom and purity. It gives them the foundation from which to view the khandhas, the outflows, and the host of Mara as not self. That foundation is not a personal position or an identity. It's a transcending position, established not on any personal quality, but on qualities that we can all develop and that take us out of our personal concerns and limitations. Being patient is definitely not self. It does not appeal to the outflows or the self-view. To them, it seems like a waste of time and even a humiliation. The transcendent, supramundane path is always a giving up of self. And giving up self becomes a far more stable and unshakable foundation than anything that comes through the processes of gaining and becoming. A couple of things to say about that. So this term, they realize their true lineage. So one of the other terms that describes stream entry, or the irreversible guarantee of enlightenment, is the change of lineage, or gotrabhu, the change of lineage consciousness. So that when the mind lets go of its attachment to the body and the personality, when there's a recognition the body is not self, the personality is not self, then that says something fairly radical about your family. If the body is not self, then what does that say about mum and dad? And our grandparents and great-grandparents and so on and so forth. So the term change of lineage is to do with letting go of that identification with the body and the personality and our biological ancestry. And instead it's saying your real lineage is the Dhamma, not just Mr. and Mrs. Horner from the Weald of Kent. That is a very direct way of considering and reflecting on how we think of what we are. And so that seeing through self-view, that dropping of identification with the I am the body, I am the personality, this is me, this is who I and what I am, to see that those are convenient fictions rather than absolute realities is to change the lineage. If you grasp that wrongly, of course, that causes a lot of problems. I remember being very enthusiastic about the Anatta teachings, and I made the very grave mistake of putting in an aerogram to my mother, you're not really my mother. Not really, which didn't go down very well, since she nearly died giving birth to me. And so I got a very blunt reply to that one, not surprisingly, because it was a stupid kind of a grasping of the idea, and also not something you put in an aerogram to your mother when you're 21 years old on the other side of the world in a war zone. And so at that time, both Laos and Cambodia Cambodia was occupied by the Khmer Rouge at that time, and the Vietnamese were just invading, and Laos had been taken over by the Pathet Lao Communist Party, and Ubon is right where Thailand meets with Laos and Cambodia. You can hear the big guns going all the time, across the river. So it was not the kind of thing to say to your mother. So we live and learn, but that's a very useful way of exploring the principle of self-view, and to just ask yourself that question: if the body is not self, then what does that say about my ancestry or where I come from? What's the lineage? If the body is not who and what I am, if my biological parents are the origin of this body, then what does this letting go of identification say about that? And it's a good way, a very effective way for some people to be able to sort of disrupt that habitual way of seeing things and to reconfigure the perceptions. Then about patience. Now the English word patience, like many of these Pali terms, that the word patience has connotations to it that don't really match the quality of the paramita of kanti. Because in English, the word patience, there's a kind of frustration. It means you're gritting your teeth and you've got the strength to wait for it all to be over. But it implies an undercurrent of resentment. I don't want to bother with this, I don't like it, but I can grit my teeth and it'll be over at some point, and I've got the oomph to be able to endure it. So that's not the paramita of patience, or kanti, but rather the patience that is talked about in kanti, and what that embodies, it's a complete letting go of time. There's no future. So true patience is not waiting. So the English word implies waiting and a looking forward to it, this unwanted thing to be over. But the paramita of kanti is not that. There's no waiting, there's no time. There's a quality of surrender. It's still, there's the presence of an unpleasant experience. But the mind, what makes it a paramita, which means a method of carrying you across to the other shore, what is the liberating quality is it's a letting go of time as well as a letting go of self. And that, so there is a being in the presence of something that's difficult or unwanted, but there's no resentment, there's no waiting, there's a complete letting go. And Lumpo Cha he's the master of these little sort of dharmic one-liners that are very useful teachings to bear in mind. So he said, a samana, a religious seeker, is one who has no future. So to most of us, the worldly method of thinking to say you've got no future, I mean, it's a punk anthem from the 1970s, I think. I forget whether it was the Damned or the Sex Pistols who sang No Future as a sort of punk anthem. But this is no future as in letting go of time. So to the worldly habits of thinking, no future is a, don't say that, because we feel shocked or intimidated or robbed or that there's a deadening of the heart because of that. But if you reflect, why would Lumpur Cha say a samana is one who has no future? That if you're really giving yourself to the spiritual principle, then you don't have a future. You're not creating a me who's passing through time. But rather, there's a complete letting go of time. And then there's obviously a mindful awareness as things unfold and choices get made, but it's not conceived in terms of me and my life and what I want to do, or what I'm dreading doing, or what I'm excited about over there. But Dhamma is a sanditiko, apparent here and now, akaliko, timeless. So giving up self becomes a far more stable and unshakable foundation than anything that comes through the processes of gaining and becoming. So that letting go of time, letting go of self, is realized as the stable foundation, because that is, in a way, the realization of Dhamma itself. And Dhamma means that which upholds. That the root is dhur, which means to hold or to support. So Dhamma is that which upholds everything. Or as John Cage, the experimental composer, put it, he called it the nothing which supports everything. Or each something is a celebration of the nothing which supports it. That's the exact phrase he used. It's at the beginning of his book called Silence. Okay. It is said that in the second watch of that night, under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha came to understand the laws of cause and effect that determine the future of all beings. This deepened his compassion and understanding of not-self. In this picture, the illustration that we've been talking about with the large, intricate border of many, 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 many little faces, animals and people of various kinds. In this picture, the Buddha is portrayed seated above a knotwork figure. The knotwork represents the links of cause and effect, of temporality, in which the Buddha is no longer operating. His perfection of good karma has led to the end of karma. He is depicted touching the ground, calling the earth to bear witness to his paramita. The hand is painted in some detail, whereas the face has no detail apart from a gentle smile. This represents the change of lineage, as I was mentioning, from the realm of personality, we normally identify with the face, to that of transcendent activity within the field of cause and effect, the cultivation of paramita. That hand reminds us that realization of truths only comes by getting in touch with fundamental things like our actual feelings and beliefs. We have to touch the earth, leave the illusions and hopes behind, and get in touch with how it really is now. We don't need to contact a special set of perceptions and feelings, but we must develop an unwavering contact with the ones that arise ordinarily. Thus, another meaning of a Tathagata is one who has come. A Buddha, having seen through cause and effect, willingly enters into it out of compassion for other beings, beings still held in the belief that they are the process of cause and effect. So this is a very important spiritual symbol. Again, it's one of these themes I talk about a lot, and that the Buddha touching the earth, as Ajahn Sucitto puts it very, very clearly and eloquently here, that this is the Buddha in terms of being an immanent presence. So Tathagata can have two meanings. We have more than that, but it can either be rendered as thus come, or it can be rendered as thus gone. Tathagata, tata, or Tathagata. Gata is from gacchami, like I go, to tata is suchness. So it can be tathagata, which means gone to suchness. Or it can be tathagata, come to suchness. So it symbolizes the quality of transcendence, of total disentanglement or letting go of all things, non-identification with all things. But it also represents that quality of immanence or suchness or participation in all things. So that's why I like to use the term unentangled participating as a way of describing that quality of awakened awareness. Also, in the imagery of the enlightenment story that we have with Mara, it's significant in the tale that even though the Buddha has fully awakened, his heart is totally liberated, the armies of Mara are still gathered around. And so you can, there's different ways of interpreting it, but the way I like to reflect on it is that the subjective experience of liberation is complete in the Buddha. His heart is totally freed. But Mara's army won't retreat. It's still gathered around and it's still threatening, even though as they throw their weapons, you know, the spears turn into beams of light and the rocks that they throw turn into flowers that rain down and so on and so forth. But so they can't harm the Buddha as he's sitting under the Bodhi tree, but they won't retreat. And then why it's called the Earth Witness Mudra, and this Buddha image here, it's probably the most common of all Buddha images from everywhere, from Siberia and Japan in the north, all the way down to Sri Lanka and Southeast Asia, that Earth Witness Mudra is the most common for Buddha images, I would say. It's very, one of the most common. And what it's representing is that the story that that Mara says is trying to fool the Buddha, saying you're a total fool. You can't claim that you could succeed as a householder. You walked out on your wife and child. You walked out on your responsibility to the kingdom to be a yogi. Then you gave up being a yogi. You couldn't stand it to be an ascetic. So you started eating ordinary food and you put on all this weight. You're like an ordinary person. And now you say that you're totally enlightened. What a joke! Yeah, who do you think you are? Yeah, you're a fool. You're a failed husband. You're a failed yogi, and now you're claiming to be the Lord of the universe. That's ridiculous. Who do you think you are? He said, "I'm actually the only one who can really claim lordship over the universe." And since I'm the king of the highest of the sensual heavens, and so I'm really the one who should claim the right to sit on the immovable spot. I should be regarded as the ruler of this realm. Isn't that so? So, and then he calls his army to be his witness. So the different accounts vary about the numbers, but hundreds of thousands of members of his army, and they all say, "Oh yes, indeed, Your Majesty, you are indeed the one." So he says, "See, look, these are my witnesses. Who have you got to call as your witness? You haven't got your wife. You haven't got your yogi friends. You're all alone. You've got nothing. Who's your witness? Come on, speak up." And so then that's when the Buddha reaches down and touches the earth with his right hand, and he calls the earth goddess, who's called Dharani, or Torani in Thai, but Dharani in the Pali Sanskrit, Dharani. And then she rises up, and then she makes this declaration. None of this is actually in the Pali canon. This is also commentarial and later literature, but in these mythological tales, she says, "This is my true son, and he has done everything that is necessary to claim full and complete enlightenment. He has fulfilled all of the 10 perfections, and he is fully self-liberated, fully awakened. And he is the only one who has the right to claim rulership over this universe. And you, Mara, are defeated." And then she unwraps her hair, and then this huge flood of water appears from her plait, and then washes the army of Mara away. So you see these pictures of sort of elephants and demons and whatnot are rolling around in the surf, flowing out of her hair, and then they all come back carrying gifts and flowers and asking for forgiveness. But that what that symbolizes, that touch, just as Ajahn Sajita says here, it's a Buddha having seen through cause and effect, willingly enters into it out of compassion for other beings. So that's the quality of participation. So it's only when, rather than trying to live in a subjective experience of the unconditioned, that also incorporates or sort of reaches out and fully embodies the conditioned as well. This quality of full, engagement and participation. There's no fear of the conditioned realm. There's no need to keep it away, because what could it harm, or what could the conditioned realm limit? Because all sankharas are not self; they're not who and what you are. So there's no need to keep them away. You can let them in. There's no need to try and abide in some sort of sterilized, unconditioned realm that doesn't want to bother with the grubby realm of convention and form and birth and death. There's no need to push it away, because how could it harm or limit or confine? So that gesture of reaching out and receiving and attuning to the conditioned as well as the unconditioned, that's what defeats Mara. And so it's through that that quality of recognizing that we participate in this life. You can't just be spiritual. You have a body. It needs to breathe. It needs to eat. Yeah, you do have a biological family. You have a place where you need to live, buildings that you need shelter in. So we are participating. There is the karma of this birth. And if you try to sort of live off in some kind of abstracted spiritual dimension, sort of trying to identify with the unconditioned, then you're ignoring the conditioned. And then what happens is that you dismiss that, or you look down on it, or you say that it doesn't matter, it has no significance. Then pretty soon the snake whips around and bites you. And the conditioned realm comes back to knock on your door and say, "Well, actually, you owe 23,000 pounds in back taxes." You might see that all dharmas are empty, but the Her Majesty's Revenue Department is seeing things differently. And so that the ignoring the needs of the body, ignoring your health concerns, ignoring your relationships with other people, you know, or overlooking yourself. Well, it's, you know, everything's empty, it doesn't really matter, you know, why bother? That most of us have probably had this kind of experience that the world has come back to bite you and say, oh yeah, empty are we? Okay, try this one for size. And then we are then tested to see whether those particular difficult conditions are indeed as empty as our theorizing mind paints them as. Okay, to continue. All we can know is that we are. Although the definition of what we are is subject to views and opinions. Is it possible to leave that suchness, that isness of being, unconditioned by our attempts to define it? Is it possible to abide in that apparent emptiness until we taste the freedom that enriches it? It is an act of trust, and the awakened ones can abide trusting in emptiness because of the rich store of paramita that has given them supreme confidence. With that, they repel Mara and come to full understanding, not purely of themselves, but of the way it is. Through this, in the third watch of the night, the Buddha came to realize the Four Noble Truths, the way of living beyond self. So I'll read that first sentence, first little bit again, because that was quite densely packed there. All we can know is that we are, in italics, although the definition of what we are is subject to views and opinions. Is it possible to leave that suchness, that isness of being, unconditioned by our attempts to define it? So can we take that quality of isness or suchness, that tata is called tatata in Pali, can we just let that quality of suchness be realized without trying to write a poem about it, or trying to conceive it or picture it or do something with it? Can that just be known and embodied? Is it possible to abide in that apparent emptiness until we taste the freedom that enriches it? So, because the habit of becoming, bhavatanna, is always uncomfortable with undefined being. You always want to be something. Even being a failure, or being a problem, or being sick is often far preferable to undefined being. So we love to have enemies. We need to have someone that's a problem. Because if they're a problem, then I exist in relationship to them, and I've got all these opinions about how you should be. So if I've got a problem with Annie, then I can carry Annie around all day long, and it gives me a sense of being, because then that woman, you know what she did, and it's just the mind takes a convenient object. And so one of the most disarming and painful things to do is to be deprived of a problem or an enemy. Or that's why when we get what we desire, often the first experience is one of disappointment. Oh no, I've been longing for that for so long. Now what am I going to want? Because I was identified with the longing, or I was identified with the hating or the fearing. Oh my goodness, nothing to fear. Quick, give me a problem. I need a problem. And if you notice, if you watch the mind closely, when you say it's ordinary, in an ordinary mundane way, say you're doing some kind of a job like cleaning up or tidying or working on a project, and you've been quite physically involved, and you've been going for a few hours, and then you plunk yourself down and you go, ah, thank goodness. So there's a few seconds of relief, like 3 or 4 seconds, I find. And then the mind starts to look for something to worry about. And we feel uncomfortable with peace. The becoming habit doesn't like peace. It wants, because in that moment there's no thing to do, no thing to be, and so we're trying to find something to worry about, or something to do, or something to be excited about, or something to be tested by, or something so that I can exist in relationship to that. You know, looking for something to push against, so we'll feel like that we're somebody. And so that the development of the third noble truth, as you remember back when talking about that section, Satchikata Bhante, it is to be realized, that there's a lot to do with letting the heart rest with suchness, with emptiness, with just undefined being. Because the habits of self-view and self-creation, the anything will do, any old garbage will do. Give me a problem, give me something, give me a memory, give me an argument I had when I was in primary school. Anything, something, just give me something. And you can see the mind, it's quite shameless, just sort of hunting around, like going through the trunks in the attic, you know, looking for something to create an identity in relationship to. And so that quality of realization of dukkha nirodha is a lot to do with recognizing that hungering, that hankering, and saying no, 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 just leave it alone, let it be. And when that is really realized, there's that satchikatanti, it has been realized, then there's a tremendous freedom. But it's very hard just to stay with that those waves of hungering and to just leave them alone. Someone who had insight into this, you might be surprised, was Marilyn Monroe. So in the film Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, she sings a very insightful song called "When You Get What You Want, You Don't Want It Anymore." So the message is out there in all kinds of dimensions. When you get what you want, you don't want it anymore. And then when you've got it, then the interesting moment is to look at that sense of disappointment, or, oh, it's just this, or starting to look for the next thing. Say, ah, see, she was right. Okay, so the Buddha is sitting on top of this knot of eternity, which he's not entangled with. And then the illustration depicts in the center of the Buddha's body a mandala, that's a yantra, technically, a spiritual theme formed into a symbol for the purpose of meditation. This particular mandala represents the union of male and female as the polarities of the universe. We can list what goes under those polarities: active, passive, constriction, expansion, form, space, and so on. As in the previous painting, the main theme here is the harmonizing of all positions. When there is unity, there is no other to flow towards or away from. When there's harmony based on a fundamental resolution of all the potential dualities, there is no possibility of desire for one of them. There's no taking a position in the masculine to be drawn towards or away from the feminine. This point of resolution is the supreme liberation, the irreversible termination of the outflows, because there's nothing to flow out to. The Buddha has lived it out. Now he is no longer fooled by any condition, any position, or any self, quote unquote. Hence he is no longer convinced that anyone is really that which is born and dies, because it becomes obvious that that true being or isness is more than a matter of temporarily holding to a position. With this insight, he can live with total sensitivity and compassion in a world of suffering beings, without anxiety or despair. As he doesn't take or hold any position regarding conditioned phenomena, he has all the possibilities of relating to them. His mind is open, free from bias, self-interest, unresolved traumas, and the rest of it. Nor is he biased towards not experiencing conditions. It's not the case that he doesn't bother with the phenomenal world either. His liberation from suffering is, therefore, a source of faith as well as an inspiration for practice for all beings. Homage to the Tathagata. So again, I'll just read that part of this paragraph just to clarify that principle. The Buddha has lived it out. Now he is no longer fooled by any condition, any position, or any self. Hence he is no longer convinced that anyone is really that which is born and dies, because it becomes obvious that that true being or isness is more than a matter of temporarily holding to a position. So like I was saying yesterday, I was using the image of waves coming into the shore, but it's just recognizing, well, this life is just a wave. Is the sea diminished when a wave breaks? Has the sea lost anything when a wave rolls in and breaks on the shore? The sea is not diminished by a wave passing through it. Or another image, different image to use about this sort of supreme objectivity over birth and death. It's rather like we say the sun rises in the east in the morning and sets in the west in the evening, but the sun doesn't rise and set according to ordinary versions of astronomy and the universe, but it's because of the spinning of the earth. As long as we're sitting on the surface of the planet, we see the sun rising and setting, but the rising and setting, the birth and death, is only apparent because of the position that we're in. If you take the position of the sun, then there's this little blue dot that you can see sort of revolving off in the vastness of space. There's no identification with which particular where in the rotation that little blue dot, the little blue and green bubble is. It's because the mind is, to just use that analogy, is occupying the isness of the sun. It's a central position. And then the births and deaths, hopes and fears, in-breath, out-breath, gains and losses are just the spinning of that little wee green and blue bubble, off in the vastness of space. What does the sun know of its risings and settings? It's not involved. It can see the spinning, but it's not identified with it in any way. With this insight, he can live with total sensitivity and compassion in a world of suffering beings, without anxiety or despair. So along with patience, the English word patience being a bit problematic and implying a quality of sort of gritted teeth and the skill of waiting, compassion is also not the right word, because literally compassion means to suffer with. It comes from the Latin compassio, com meaning with, passio to suffer. So compassion in English means to suffer with. But compassion in the Buddhist psychology is not a state of suffering. So karuna, to feel compassion for another, does not produce suffering in the person who's experiencing or cultivating compassion. It's not a state of suffering. And the Buddha, at one point, says if suffering arises on account of the development of compassion, then that karuna is tainted. It's incomplete. It's distorted. It's not true compassion. So probably the better English word is empathy, to empathize with the suffering of another being. Compassion is more the term that gets used, but it's also, as he's saying, that the Buddha, the awakened one, can live in the world of suffering beings without being caused suffering on account of that. There's another word that's related to karuna, which is anukampa, like when we do the chant for the requesting a Dhamma talk, anukampi mang pajang. Anukampati means literally to resonate with or to tremble. And so that gets translated as the Buddha trembling for the welfare of all beings. So there's a sense of empathizing or concern, but without that being a state of suffering. As he doesn't take hold or hold any position regarding conditioned phenomena, he has all the possibilities of relating to them, because you're not identifying with any particular spot on the face of the earth, then you can relate to all of them equally. It's one of the reasons why Ajahn Chah was, people would ask him about celibacy and why don't you have a wife and children, and then you'd be a great father. And he said, well, if I have my own personal family, then I can't relate to all the other beings of the world in an equal way. And so that by adopting the quality of celibacy, then you at least even on the social level, you take the position of being able to relate to all beings in an equal and unbiased way. That he said, if you're celibate, then everyone becomes your family. If you've got your own partner and children and so on, then you have to relate to them in a different way. They are in a karmically in a different category. His mind is open, free from bias, self-interest, unresolved traumas, and the rest of it. Nor is he biased towards not experiencing conditions. As I was saying, that the liberated mind is not afraid of respecting the conditioned world. It's not pushing it away or neglecting it or looking down on it or dismissing it. So along with being totally liberated, the Buddha was also extremely careful and scrupulous about all his actions and every word that he spoke. It's not the case that he doesn't bother with the phenomenal world either. His liberation from suffering is, therefore, a source of faith as well as an inspiration for practice for all beings. Homage to the Tathagata. So, it's the end of that chapter. Any questions? Clarifications? Yes, Walter.
I don't understand the term of outflow. Mm-hmm. I just can imagine, but I don't really understand it. Maybe you can understand.
Well, outflow is the word asava. It has it's one another one that's translated in various different ways. It has the implications both of flowing and also of rotting. Something so Ajahn Tanisaro uses the word effluent, the effluence, which literally does mean flowing out, but also sounds like sewage as well, like from a drain. So when you say, but nobody else has uses effluent. I mean, he carries on, he's determined to get certain terms translated in particular ways, like Nibbana is unbinding in his vernacular. And the asava, the effluence, but it always brings to mind sewage pipes to me. And I can't really get, and then you get these weird terms, effluentless. So I.B. Horner and the Pali Text Society, they often would translate asava as cankers. And a canker is like a kind of rotting tumor, like a sore that's got lots of pus and such like. And so you get these strange terms like when someone who's the asava have diminished or have stopped. So Ajahn Tanisaro uses the term effluentless, which is pretty strange. But the I.B. Horner and the Pali text people, they come up with canker waned. To wane, like the waning moon or the diminishing. So that. And the Pali term is kinasava, like who's the kina is to end or to stop, so that it comes out as 500 canker-waned arahants. So even if English is your first language, it's a pretty weird kind of a comment. So I prefer the more everyday term outflows, because what it's representing is say the attention flowing out into an object, like that you're. And there's four different kinds of asava that are talked about. So you have kamasava, the mind flowing out into sense desire, like wanting a particular taste or wanting a particular visual object or a sound that's attractive. The mind absorbs into something, a beautiful piece of music or a delicious food or a beautiful thing to look at. So that would be kamasava. And I think that we can all relate to that when we say getting lost in something. That's an outflow. You've gone into it and you got lost to it. I was totally absorbed in that book. And I got really sucked into that movie. So it's exactly that. The mind pulled into an object. So then, kamasava is the first one. K long A-M-A, kamasava. And then bhavasava, the outflow of becoming. So being, say, looking into the future, you know, and absorbed in planning for the future, the ambition, what you're going to become, what you're going to get. And not necessarily around sense desire, it can also be, I want to become a stream enterer. I want to become, if Sarakani the drunk can do it, I can do it. Yeah, I'm going to become. So that's bhavasava, the outflow of becoming. Then dittasava is views and opinions. Ditti is a view. So believing in your opinions. When you say, I think Theravada Buddhism is great, Mahayana Buddhism is rubbish, you know, Theravada is the best. And so that's dittasava, the mind absorbing into an opinion or a view, and that's kind of believing that your thought is an absolute truth. So that again, the mind lost in a view or an opinion and born into that. And then the fourth one is avijjasava, as in avijja as in ignorance. And so that's a bit more general, but it you could say it's really the mind flowing out into the basic ignorant point of view of I am, the feeling of identity, like I'm experiencing. So it's not necessarily caught up in an opinion or an ambition or a sense desire, but just caught in the I am, and there's the world out there, I am this, that. That's one way of looking at avijjasava. So the mind is absorbed and lost in that I am this person feeling, that attitude. So that, I don't know if that clarifies it at all. And so that the arahantship is the ending of the asavas. So the mind stops flowing out and getting caught up. It doesn't get absorbed. So there's still seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, opinions arise and pass away. But if the asavas are stopped, the mind is not flowing out. As Master Hua, who was when he came here in 1989, he brought a large group of his students, nuns and monks, to visit Britain and Europe. And one of the questions somebody asked him when he was here is that, you know, you're abbot of 20 or so monasteries, you have thousands and thousands of disciples and so many, you know, calls on your time, and people are coming to see you and ask for teachings all day long. Now, how do you manage to deal with all this activity? And like City of 10,000 Buddhas, their main place in California, has not just one school, it has four schools and a university in the monastery. A senior and junior girls' school, and a senior and junior boys' school, and a university. And the monastic training for all the nuns and monks are there. It's a huge place, and that's just one place, and he has like about 20 different places around the world. And he made the comment, I don't go out, I stay in. it was just a very, very simple statement, that I don't go out. Not meaning that he didn't go out of buildings, or he just, when he's with people, and he says, I don't go out, I stay in. As they asked a few more questions about, well, what about, like, if they're having a face-to-face conversation and someone's got really upset or really excited, or, you know, how do you maintain that kind of clarity when it's a real sort of face-to-face personal contact like that? And what he said was that I don't look them in the eyes; I look between their eyes. Because looking at someone right in the eyes is a guaranteed way to lose yourself. That's what just in a personal conversation. That's how you get lost. That's how you go out. You're drawn into the other because the eyes are so powerful. So he said that just a little kind of handy hint. just look at the spot between their eyes rather than into their eyes. He says, they won't notice, but you. You can still maintain that quality of clarity as you're engaging.